This is Jorn, once again, coming to you from the bridge of our shuttle. Jajim, set course for Boroth. We need to get back to Kartan and learn more of the history of Kalis.
Course set.
We're back on Boroth. We're in the presence of the great cleric Kartan. Tonight, he is going to tell us some of the early history of Kalis so that we may learn how he came to discover the philosophies that he is going to give to the rest of the Klingon people. Kartan, what have you to say?
Well, first, Kavan, and welcome to Boroth. I am eager to share some wisdom of the history of Kalis with you. As I have talked with you before, as we impart the wisdom of Kalis on the warriors of the Empire, as well as our allies in the Federation, I've come to realize that people tend to focus on the better known stories of the battles that Kalis fought, particularly those to unite the Empire, his warrior ways and wisdom. And these are the things that we tend to repeat over and over again, but I feel like we oftentimes forget the early history. Now, keep in mind, there is not much. The ancient texts are, there's only scraps and fragments, but we've been able to glean a narrative. Those who have read the Pakpak have certainly studied this, and that's what we'll be looking at today. We are going to go back and look at his early life before he began his campaign against Molor.
What is the Pakpak for some of our listeners?
Absolutely. So another thing that we had discussed is, again, knowing that oftentimes my audiences are allies from the Federation and in Starfleet Academy who are just being introduced to Klingon culture, do not know the language, and may not know many of the things that we take for granted. I will be very careful to do my best to explain allegories in ways that humans could understand. The Pakpak is a Klingon epic told in a poetic form. It's been translated into verse and opera. Again, very fragmentary. So sometimes artistic license has been taken. It has been compared by some human sociologists to texts that they are familiar with, the Bhagavad Gita, the Torah, the Bible. I'm not sure those are necessarily the best examples. I've heard of the Epic of Gilgamesh, which actually I have seen translated into Klingon. Very much, in my opinion, a better example of what the Pakpak is.
Let me give an example of what the Pakpak is by actually reading from it. Now,
sure, absolutely.
I'm not going to try to read the Klingon because, as with your name, you see, will I butcher it? But the English text, my Klingon brother, why are you out here where even the lynx doesn't grow? Can I help a fellow Klingon in need? May I sit? May I rest with you? From Kalis. Dear old friend, I cannot speak of my tragedies. There is nothing left of me, warrior. If you don't want my help, then let's light a fire and drink. Have some blood wine. Kalis. Let us drink then. To my father in Greythor, and my brother I once had. Warrior. You are here for great deeds. Your journey will not be forgotten. Restore the honor of your father.
Very good. Yes. And in fact, that is the 10th canto. I will be getting at least up to there tonight.
I was wondering what that 10 was, but my God, you picked it up just like that.
Well, I certainly know the cantos of the Pakpak. No doubt about it. So to kind of set the stage first, as I had mentioned earlier, these are very fragmentary texts, and I have notes where we have scraps, a few lines, some lines are missing, and so forth. But I also feel like even if we could go back in time and we could, you know, somehow read the original texts as they were originally written before the ink has even dried, I kind of imagine that the teller of these tales might have glossed over this period in history. I think as we tend to focus on the action of the story, I think that the forefathers also kind of said, well, Kalos came and he grew up and then the good stuff happened. But there are certain elements in a child's life that are absolutely necessary for a man to become the man he will be, and especially an epic hero. I have drawn the example that there is a story, a character in human culture and religion that some have actually compared to Kalesh, a Judeo-Christian messiah called Jesus of Nazareth. And his story is a very brief one that talks about his birth, and then there's like one line about his childhood, and then suddenly he's a fully grown man. And it's actually not a bad comparison. Kalesh, his story is very similar. In fact, we don't even have a birth story for Kalesh. There is no big momentous, there was a star in the sky and a thunderclap or anything. It's very important, at least it was to Kalesh, that people remember this about him, that he was a man, okay? That just as any other man, he was born, grew up, but as any warrior, he was thrown into situations that he may not have even chosen, and through happenstance was forced to make choices, to be great. And out of necessity, he chose to be great. So we're going to look at some of that today. Now, the Pakbak does go back basically to the dawn of time. That's a little further back than we're going to go today, because we are going to focus on Kalesh, okay? But we are going to start right as I would if I was doing a lesson to the people. So again, this is written in verse and oftentimes presented as an opera. So it's different voices that are speaking. And as I go through, I'll explain who is singing. And the first voice, it's been translated many ways. The literal translation that I've heard is Master of the Scream. I've worked with translation of Klingon into the Terran language, and I think that a translation I think that gives a better flavor of the meaning is Lore Singer. And those of us from the homeworld know what a Lore Singer is. You've seen them at their dais outside the Great Hall, speaking and singing the songs of Kalesh. So that is the Lore Singer. And the Lore Singer begins, "Hear now, all of you here, proud warriors of Khotnosh, the ways of Kalesh, for they are true and unforgettable. Hear now, all of you here, of the life and death of one who fought against the odds and even gods. Hear now, all of you here, why we go to Shtovokor and greet our Kalesh there, to join him in battle for eternity, to join him in battle, join him in battle for eternity. We meet our Kalesh there, to join him for eternity." Now, a word on the prose here, okay? You get repetition. And I am going to repeat it the way it is in the text, and here is why. If it's repeated, it's important, and it's meant to be remembered. And oftentimes, you will hear children recite these repeated phrases over and over again, and that's a good thing, okay? And they weave themselves into our culture, and it is important. So when we talk about joining him in battle for eternity, we meet our Kalesh there, to join him for eternity. Think about what eternity is, okay? That's a long time. And the lives that we live are short. Even if we live to a great old age, even if we did not die in battle, out of all of eternity, our lives are short. So when we repeat talking about joining him in battle for all eternity, and we repeat that over and over again, we're getting across that is what we are looking forward to. These trials we live here are nothing compared to the glory that we are looking forward to in the afterlife in Shtovokor with Kalesh. So that is the prologue. And the first story that we get is not a story of the birth of Kalesh. It is not a journey that someone took to witness the birth of some great king. In fact, it's very clear that Kalesh was not what you'd call a peerage. He was not of a great house to begin with. He was a farmer, basically a commoner, okay? Now, there is no dishonor in that, but that's the station that he came from. And for an epic hero, how amazing is it that he became the greatest Klingon in history from such humble roots? But I would argue that that is important because it is that hero's journey that makes a hero. Heroes are not made whole cloth. They forge themselves over time. And of course, happenstance certainly plays a role in that. So we begin with the first canto, which is called Wam, okay, the hunt. And the lore singer says, "See the spy creeping, he will feed on the weak-hearted. See the targ, an easy prey. Morath, as you failed to kill your prey, so will Molor fail to conquer his Kalesh. Be aware of danger in all forms. Kalesh, pull your diktag, kill the beast in this forest. One a targ, and two who call themselves Klingon." Now, in this description of a hunt, we have two brothers. We have Kalesh and Molor, and they are on a normal hunt for a targ to bring back for dinner. This is probably something they did, I don't know, every day, every week, whatever. But as you know, among Klingons, there are traditions. There is a way that hunting is done. And a human term that I've heard is there is a pecking order, you know, to the family, to the hunt. One is in charge. There is a struggle being set up here, okay? And a very obvious foreshadowing. So as it talks about the hunt that is about to happen, Kalesh and Morath, we are also foreshadowing a hunt of a kind between Molor and Kalesh. And you'll see how those two things kind of mirror each other in a bit. What I also want to point out is this struggle that is being set up between Morath and Kalesh, okay? This idea of brothers struggling, because what it ends up becoming is the normal order of things is that Kalesh is the elder brother. He should be taking over the house, the household, from his father when his father dies, all things being equal. But Morath does not like that idea. He wants to be the son to take over. He is envious of the fact that Kalesh is the elder brother, that he is the leader when his father is not around. And in this current hunt, Kalesh is taking a leadership role. And this idea of brothers struggling is very common across civilizations. And I did make reference to the Torah in Earth's history. The first book of the Torah has a number of stories about brothers. The very first is the first two brothers, Cain and Abel. Cain being a brother who was envious of his brother Abel. It's kind of unclear exactly why Abel was more beloved to their deity over Cain. But for whatever reason, he was jealous and he murders his brother, and it leads to all the strife in the world, so to speak. An even better example is a few chapters later, a story about brothers Jacob and Esau, okay? And in fact, I want to read that particular story because it relates so well to what we're going to be talking about in just a second. So So once when Jacob was cooking a stew, Esau came home from the field, and he was famished. Esau said to Jacob, "Let me eat some of that red stuff. I am famished." Therefore, he was called Edom. Jacob said, "First, sell me your birthright." Esau said, "I am about to die. Of what use is a birthright to me?" Jacob said, "Swear to me first." So he swore to him and sold his birthright to Jacob. Then Jacob gave Esau bread and lentil stew, and he ate and drank and rose and went on his way. Thus, Esau despised his birthright. Okay, so we have a story of another situation. One brother who is an elder brother, another one who is younger, and he wants to take his brother's place as the rightful heir. And he convinces his brother to sell that birthright for some stew because he was so hungry, okay? Now, temptation with food, that plays into Klingon culture too in the wedding ceremony and the groom's preparations beforehand. We'll talk about that on another day. But this idea of allowing your baser instincts to override honor is just anathema. And that's not what we see here, but we do definitely see Morath kind of trying to find a way to finagle that birthright away from Kalash. So we go on to Canto 2, humiliation. Now we're going to see what happened in this battle. And this is Kalash speaking. "My brother, you failed to kill. The head is my reward. You bring the carcass home. This way, you will feel the burden of shame on you and your house." And Morath says, "One day, brother Kalash, you will bow for me as leader of our house. One day, brother Kalash, you will not be laughing. One day, one day, one day." So here's how the hunt went. Apparently, they were after Targ, which we were told in the previous canto is an easy prey. It is. It can be dangerous, but by and large, it is one of the simpler prey, very common. And apparently, when it came right down to it, Morath failed. He was unable to complete the kill. So Kalash drew his diktach and slew the beast. And he said, "I claim the right to carry the head. You will be burdened with carrying the rest of the body." And thereby, people see who was the victor today. Now, this is a passage I've always struggled with a little bit. It says, "This way you will feel the burden of shame." Okay, I understand that. "On you and your house." Since he's talking to his brother, would that not mean that he has brought shame on the family in general? I think it's a little overstated, but it does seem to go along with what Morath says later, "One day, brother Kalash, you will not be laughing." I have always read "on you and your house" as a little bit of a jibe, okay? You are dishonored today, so you have brought shame on our house. But I think Kalash is overstating it a little bit just to needle his brother a little bit. And I don't think he means it in a mean and malicious way, maybe a little playful, and certainly to call him to better the next time. That is my
interpretation. Yeah, I was kind of wondering about that. "And your house" also, when you're reading it the first time. Because, yeah, his house is Kalash's house, too, so.
Well, think about it this way.
What's going on?
Yeah, think about it this way. What if I were to say to you, okay, "You have brought shame on all of us, and what you've actually done is something very, very minor." Okay, you'd look at me and go, yeah, feel the shame, you know? But he struck a nerve because Morath already has this anger in his heart. So instead of receiving it as a call to do better and maybe a little jovial mocking from his brother, he internalizes it and allows it to turn to wrath in his heart. That's how I've always interpreted this. Okay.
Is this something we should be seeing in Klingon culture? The using of points like this to try and increase a person's honor and attempts at being better, but that can backfire and cause animosity that could last for lifetimes.
Yes. So my interaction with the humans have, and Klingon interaction with the Vulcans, which is even more challenging in my opinion. But those interactions have exposed us to different ways of thinking. Okay. Now, I don't want to go too far down a hole here. I mean, you can look at the epic of Hamlet and a Klingon that studied under Vulcan educational system and lost his way and was not quick to fight for honor and tried to live the life of a pacifist. And that's all kinds of craziness. But there is wisdom in other cultures and their way of looking at it. Sometimes just stepping out of your own culture and looking at things in a different way. And one of the things that I have learned from humans is a concept called empathy. We tend to associate that term with races like the Beta Zeds, but I'm talking more a kind of empathy where it's a cunning way of looking at emotion. We often talk about how you have to think like your prey or think like your enemy, okay? And sometimes you have to think like your friends to understand them. Sometimes they don't understand things the way you do. And you have to sometimes imagine, if I was standing on the bridge of that ship, what would my ship look like when you're in combat? Well, in the same way, when you are a teacher, you have to think, how does my student interpret what I'm saying? I need to make sure that what I think I'm saying is what they are actually hearing. And I would argue that as a student, when you are struggling with something your teacher is saying, it is incumbent on you to communicate if you disagree with your teacher or if you just feel that you are deficient in understanding and need it repeated in a different way. And that comes down to questions of honor as well. When do you challenge an authority? And when are you challenging yourself and asking for aid from your teacher? So yes, that was a very long-winded answer to get to, yes, I do believe that there is a reason that this fragment of Canto 2 exists. And I believe it's to teach that lesson. And I think that it is very short-sighted that it is not a repeated story like The Wind Does Not Respect a Fool or the story of Kamchi and so many others. You know, we talk about great battles, and those are great stories and great lessons to be learned. But sometimes a character lesson like this is a very important kernel of honor. Wouldn't you agree?
Well, I think we see something similar in Worf's reaction to the prisoners he stumbles on that haven't learned Klingon culture. And he has to take one of the youngsters out on the youngster's first hunt and teach him how to respect the prey, how to think like the prey, how to approach the prey.
Okay, that is exactly what I was getting at. When you are hunting, okay, why? Why do you have to think like the prey? Because you have to anticipate what the prey is going to do. When you throw your spear, you expect to hit your prey and kill it. But wisdom tells you, you may not. You may miss. Or you may injure your prey. And you've got to think, what would this prey do? Now, the way a Targ is going to react may be very different than the way a Grishnar will react. And both are going to be very different from a Klingon enemy, right? Is that prey going to be scared and run? Are they going to struggle? Or are they going to charge and attack? These are all things that you have to think about. And if it was just you, you might say, well, of course, it's going to charge and attack. And then you would be surprised when it turns and runs because it does not think like you. You have to think like it, right? So that's why this story of the hunt and the outcome, the humiliation of the failure is so important, and how it leads Morath down a very dishonorable path. So as we get into Canto 3, I'm going to go ahead and read it through, and then we're going to go back and kind of break it down, because there's a lot to chew on here. So Canto 3 is The Offer, and the first voice is Morath, who encounters someone in the woods. What is an envoy of Molor, son of Markhag, doing in these woods? You are far away from home, stranger. The envoy responds, you speak wise words. The people of Shakshub will be proud of a leader like you. How would you like to keep that promise very soon? Open the gates for us. I can offer you your house, and your kin will die with honor. Morath, I will consider your offer. You will give me the house, and no blood will be shed. Envoy, decide when the Kahrol cries. The choice is yours, and it is obvious. Now, who is this envoy of Molor? I have heard different interpretations. One interpretation is that this is Molor himself acting as an envoy. I think that's unlikely. And oftentimes when this opera is performed, the same actor plays the envoy that plays Molor, which I think is fine, because there is a representation. What is an envoy? An envoy is someone who speaks with the voice of he who sent him. So this envoy, who's really just a messenger, okay, he speaks with Molor's voice. He is offering something that Molor has sent him to say. So, but I don't think historically this would have actually been Molor sneaking, you know, leaving his castle, his palace, you know, his throne room, and coming and talking to, you know, some second son of a farmer. But this is why oftentimes you will see this referred to as the same person as Molor. But what is this envoy doing? He is acting as a tempter. He is offering a very surreptitious way that he's playing on Morath's desire to usurp his brother and take over his household. And here's the offer that he's given. Look, Molor is going to come to Shakshub. Okay, Shakshub is the town, the stronghold, the lands that Kalash and his family take care of. There's no way to know, but it seems likely that this was a fortified community. There's a wall, there's a gate, and to take these lands, a warlord needs to get in through the gate or break down the wall. So the easiest way, not to have a long protracted siege, is to convince somebody inside to be a confederate, to open the doors for them so that you can march your armies in and take over. And how do you convince somebody to do that? Well, you offer them what they want. They want these lands to be theirs. So you let us in, we will take over these lands and we will put you in charge as the local governor. And you'll notice that the envoy says, open the gates for us, I can offer you your house, and your kin will die with honor. And that seems pretty straightforward, because Kalash and their father are going to fight and die, and they will die with honor, which would leave Morath the last son, and therefore inheriting the house. But what does Morath say? I will consider your offer. You give me the house, and no blood will be shed. So he's trying to alter the deal. And in no way does the envoy say, yeah, okay, we'll go with that option instead. He just says, you make your decision before the Kahrol cries. Kahrol, for the humans that might be listening, is a Klingon bird, a very large bird that crows at dawn. It's usually used by farmers as an indication that it's time to wake up and, you know, start doing your duties for the day. So in other words, the envoy is saying, before dawn, you need to make this decision. We'll be, you know, expecting you to open those gates for us. But he has not altered the deal. He is still saying your kin will die with honor. So kind of broadcasting to Morath what's going to happen here, right? So he should kind of be aware of what's going to happen. So then we go on to Canto 4, Waiting for Death to Come. Now, this is another one of those cantos with a lot of repetition. And the way this is usually done in an opera is the lore singer sings the verse, and then there is a response from the audience, which repeats. So, lore singer, they sneak and they creep, the men of mighty Malor, like beasts in the dark. And then all together, in the Shakshub, all is quiet, its warriors asleep like children, waiting for death to come, in their homes, waiting for death to come, the lore singer. Then the Khatrol raises voice, the signal for Morath, to loose his pride and claim a throne. He leaves his kin, unlocks the gates. The army closes in, smelling blood. O Morath, and you know this. All. In the Shakshub, all is quiet. Its warriors asleep like children, waiting for death to come. In their homes, waiting for death to come, the lore singer. The fires burst under the roofs of the Shakshub ancient houses. Flames have no mercy for anyone. Morath knows he has been a fool. His promised kingdom will be ash by the time he claims the sword. How does a coward claim a sword? By taking it from his sleeping father. So he did. Morath wakes his father, the old Khanjit. His heart's weak but proud. The response, in the Shakshub, all is quiet, its warriors asleep like children, waiting for death to come, in their homes, waiting for death to come, death to come. Now there's a lot to unpack here, so let's take a step back. I want to look at that responsorial for a second. One more time, I'm going to repeat it. In the Shakshub, all is quiet, okay? In the town where they live, in the gated community, it's quiet. It's warriors asleep like children. Now, previously, the envoy said that Morath's family would be able to die with honor. The assumption being they would fight and die, and that's what would happen. But that's not what actually happens. What actually happens is they set fire to everything. And you cannot fight fire and win as though fighting an enemy in honorable combat, right? So they are like children being slaughtered in their beds, waiting for death. And as you know, waiting for death is not an honorable thing, right? It is, you are being denied honor, being able to face your enemy, dying in your bed. This is actually in the Pakhbat and in written history. I think this is the first example we have of the concept of waiting for death and its role in an ignoble death. But let me continue. So
we see this a bit in the chronicles of the IKV Gorkhan, where Clag's father has been taken prisoner and released, and decides that he is going to spend the rest of his life waiting for death. And Clag takes a dishonorable perspective to his father until he decides that he's going to try and redeem his father's honor by taking his father's arm and replacing the useless arm that he has with his father's arm to continue fighting.
Right. And it's an interesting take, right? It's not a popular one. Not all Klingons would necessarily look at it. Basically, they would say, would Kalesh consider that to be honorable? And it's been my experience that sometimes when there's a question of honor, honor can oftentimes be in the eye of the beholder. And sometimes it requires an honorable heart to find an honorable solution. Okay? And
like
what do I mean? Pardon
like
me? Yes, exactly.
When he had to fend off all those Jem'Hadar ships with a single bird of prey, because he realized that he was too old to keep fighting, so he had to do one last stand to protect the Rotaran so it could escape.
Right. Right. And I would say that another example is, you had mentioned the Klingon who grew up in human culture, Worf, the ambassador, he one time had a situation where he was injured. He had a spinal injury that left him paralyzed from the waist down. Now, to claim an honorable warrior's death, he should have ended his life right there. Okay, there are honorable ways to go about that. But in his mind, he was not done fighting. So he chose a different option. He chose to go ahead with an experimental surgery that replaced his spine. And what it ended up doing was allowing him to walk again and to continue to fight as a warrior. The outcome...
Well, it did take some coaching, because at first he asked Riker to bring him the blade so he could commit the suicide, yep. Ritual suicide. And then he was about to ask his son to bring him the blade until he realized what that would do to Alexander. So when he was presented with the experimental treatment, he was ready to receive that as a chance to get back on his feet, to get back fighting again.
Right. And so that we don't go too far off on a tangent, I will put aside Ambassador Worf having grown up among humans, you know, his son Alexander also growing up among humans. Not always the best examples of Klingon culture, but they do make a good illustration in this case. So...
But I'm thinking in this particular case,
yes,
Worf has to go through all those thoughts.
In other words, the Hechbat was not his only option, okay? Tradition said it was, but he says, but I'm not done fighting yet. And maybe it wasn't an ordinary traditional fight, right? It was a fight against medical technology, against normal traditions, but it ended up paying off. He ended up winning a battle that allowed him to continue to fight many more battles in the future. This is a debate that I have had, and I am kind of going off on a tangent, but it's something I feel strongly about, so I hope you will indulge me.
Well, let me point out to you that Captain Clegg, goes through the same struggle, just not as drastically as Worf's, but he's got to decide what he's going to do. Is he going to mope around and only use a one-handed blade for the rest of his life, or is he going to take the chance the doctor is giving him to reattach an arm and become the two-handed warrior again?
And that is what I consider to be an even better example, okay, of looking at a modern situation with new tools and new technologies and applying it to our traditional ways, okay? Tradition says, now is time for the Hechbat, or my family has been dishonored, my only option is Mach Tovor. But sometimes that's not the only option, and it is not even the most honorable option. It's sometimes the easier option. It is easier for me to die now and claim a place in Stovokor than it is to continue to fight and gain more glory in this life, so that when I go to Stovokor eventually, I will have even more glory in the afterlife. That's a much more heroic way to look at it. So I would argue that, yes, you choose some medical option, not because you're trying to avoid death, but because you are fighting death, because you are not done fighting. And if you die on the operating table, how is that any different than dying before a superior enemy? There is no honor, or there is no dishonor in falling before a superior enemy. And ultimately, we all fall to the superior enemy, which is death. True?
Of course.
I feel that we have done a great disservice to the scientists in our community that study medicine. If we were to go into battle and our batla were to break, would we cast it aside? Or would we pick up the two halves of our batla and continue to fight with two blades?
Or we may just jam it onto a stick and make it the
And make it weapon. An akleth. Exactly. That's exactly right. If you are in a bird of prey, okay, and that bird of prey, the engines are damaged and you are left faltering, do you just blow up the ship, or do you allow yourself to be towed back to a starbase so that ship can be restored, maybe even upgraded, and then go back into battle. There is no reason to waste resources. What is more valuable, a ship, a Bot'leth, or a warrior? A warrior is the most valuable weapon any army has. And I think that sometimes we are too quick to claim our own personal glory over the greater glory of the Empire and the greater good.
Jim, jump in here. I'm trying to remember the doctor's name from the Gorkon series, because she had one hell of a time convincing the Klingon High Command that fixing, healing warriors so they could go back into battle was an honorable thing to do.
Wasn't it Borok?
Could be, but you know what I'm talking about.
Yes, I do. Yeah, she was definitely for sending people back, healing them and sending them back. And she also, that's why she wanted to fix Clegg's arm, in which she took Clegg's father, his arm, and put it on Clegg. And Clegg was ridiculed for that quite a bit.
In fact, it took an edict from Martok to get her medical expertise put into the Klingon Medical Society so that you could heal the warriors that had been wounded so they could get back into the fight.
Right. That's exactly right. And as I said, why would you value a warrior any less than your own ship? Because if you don't value the life of your warriors, and they should just turn to the Hegbot whenever they're injured, then why do we have engineers on our ships repairing them and keeping them running? We should destroy the ship every time, you know, it's in any way damaged. And that's foolish. So it's equally foolish to think that because you've lost an arm, because you've lost a leg, you've lost an eye, you should commit the Hegbot. You're paralyzed from the waist down. Do your arms not work?
Well, there's also the thing, too, of if you look at the difference, and there is a difference, between a warrior and a soldier, okay? A warrior is a individual who's going to fight with whatever means are available, and a soldier is one that's going to obey orders and stay with his pack, and the pack is going to act like a single warrior.
And do a job as they're told to do. Exactly right. And I think a soldier does have that mentality. What do I do now? Now my
That's
duty
the way
says that I do...
That's the way they're trained.
Exactly. But you're absolutely right. A warrior doesn't care. In the absence of orders, they'll find another way. And they'll find another way. And I've lost my legs. Now I will drag myself on my arms to fight. And I've lost my sword. I will use my teeth. I will not stop.
Or the story of Clegg, where he lost his arm, he pulled out his mechla and he kept fighting and eventually won the day.
Exactly. Exactly. Is it dishonorable that he lost his arm? No. It's glorious that he won the victory against the odds.
And
no,
he did
you're
it
absolutely right.
Thinking outside the box, like a warrior.
Exactly. And that's what I'm talking about when I say sometimes some wisdom comes thinking not like a Klingon, but looking to our allies and our enemies and thinking a different way.
And this is how that doctor learned about medical procedures to repair the warriors to get them back into battle. She studied under the Federation's medical program and brought what she learned back to the Klingon Empire.
Yep. But no, you're absolutely right. And there's something to be said for we as a species. We have the Brak'lul, right? We have redundancies in our system. There is a passage here that translates as hearts, and it says hearts plural. Klingons do not have more than one heart. They have a single eight-chambered heart. But I guess the humans tend to think of that as being two hearts. It's odd, but they have a different anatomy than we do. So
It's that redundancy that you were talking about.
Yeah, they misunderstand the Brechlal, you know, whereas it's true that we do have two organs of many kinds that humans do not have. We also only have one heart, but it happens to have eight chambers, whereas theirs only have four. They are fragile creatures, but that's beside the point.
But if they have eight chambers, the sound of the heartbeat is going to sound like two hearts.
It sounds very similar to the human four-chambered heart, as if it was echoing. Every part of it is. So instead of a lump, 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 it's lump, 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 lump. Yeah, it's very, very different. Let's bring it back in. Let's go back to, so waiting for death to come, right? So Morath realizes that he was foolish. And I've always wondered if, okay, so literally his house is burning down. And what does he do? He goes to take the sword from his father. So he literally is laying claim to a burning house. And he is going to fight in a burning house. This is not that passage, but I have to wonder if this is not the story that Kalesh refers to later on when he talks about a fool fighting in a burning house. I definitely see that kind of foreshadowing being mentioned here. Oh, and here it is. Morath wakes his father, the old Khanjit. His heart's weak but proud. It's one heart with eight chambers, just to be clear about that. Khanjit is not some sort of a mutant that has an additional heart. He is weak in his old age, but he is proud. He still has honor, and he can still fight. And that brings us to Canto 5, Father and Son. Morath, surrender, father. Surrender while you can. Surrender or we'll die. Khanjit, I see now I have failed to raise my man. Water flows through his veins. Morath, you coward, give me my sword and get out of my way. Do not resist me, son. Father and son fighting, there is nothing worse. Morath, old man, what do you know? I will fight you if I must. Khanjit, you have water running through your veins. Give it to me, I command you. Morath, there will be nothing to command ever again. Wow, again. Few words, but a lot to unpack here. Okay, let's start with the first phrase. Surrender, father. Surrender while you can. Surrender or we'll die. This is actually a pretty decent translation. Bijech be' chuch vaj maher. So we'll die. It's not surrender or you'll die. He's not even expressing concern for his father. He is expressing concern for himself, but phrasing it in such a way that father is going to think about the family and he's going to be concerned about all of us. So I'm going to say we. It's a very dishonorable, very pitiful way that he's acting here. Very cowardly. And what is Khanjit's first response? Not to curse his son. He says, I see now I have failed to raise my son a man. His first reaction is to realize that he, as a father, failed. It's his failing first that his son is the way that he is and is behaving the way that he has. And what does he say? To raise my son a man. He is saying Morath is not a man. A man would not be this dishonorable, would not be behaving in this way. He calls him a coward, and yet he says, give me my sword and get out of my way. You don't tell your son to give you your sword if you've completely disowned him. It appears to me in this moment, he is about to teach his son one last lesson. He is not casting his son out. This is still his son. He says, give me my sword, as a father would say to a son before going into combat. And I think Khanjit knows he's going to go out there to fight the invading army, and he is going to die. And he will die an honorable warrior's death and thereby demonstrate a final lesson to his son and be an example. But that's not what Morath wants. Morath wants to fight his father because he knows this is a combat he'll be able to win. But what is his conclusion? There will be nothing to command ever again. This, I believe, is a literary license, okay? He is basically telling his father, you no longer command me. I command myself. There is nothing for you to command any longer. But the way it is phrased, not ve daraka, there will be nothing to command by either of them because it's all burning down around them. You know, whether or not Morath consciously is aware of that fact and taking that into account doesn't matter. That is the truth. That is what's happening. So we then move into Canto 6, Father's Death. And the lore singer begins, "What is this? I wake up to the sound of battle." So the narrator, the lore singer, is speaking for the other soldiers that are now beginning to wake up. "What is this? I wake up to the sound of battle between my kin. What's going on? We're under attack. It's a civil war." Khanjeet, "My son, I have failed. I've raised you without honor. Go now, leave me, and get your brother. Malor must be stopped. Go, go, go." Kalesh, "You did not raise me a coward. I will prove it to you. Go now to Grathor. Your honor will be saved. I will return to this house victorious. Victorious, victorious. Morath, I will hunt you down. Petach, petach, petach." Again, you have that repetition, right? You have victorious, 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 as opposed to petach, petach, petach. He's cursing his brother, but promising to his father, who is dying a dishonorable death, for all intents and purposes, "I will restore your honor," right? So he acknowledges, "Yep, you messed up with my brother, and I see why you say that you're dishonored. But I take over, I take up your sword as the firstborn of the family, and it is my duty to restore your honor. I will do this thing." Which leads us to 7, the pursuit. "The brothers ran from their home. Neither one gives up, running over the black hills until Kristak blocks their path." They run over the black hills until there's this giant volcano in front of them. Canto 8, prelude to the fight.
I was going to say, Kristak, for those people that aren't aware of it, is a fixture on Kronos, and you say it's a volcano.
Right. Right. Mount Kristak is a volcano. This is, it has a lot of historical significance. Everyone knows it as the place where Kalesh forges the first Batleth, right? But it's also thought to be, and in an upcoming canto we will see this, an entrance to Grathor. Just as people have had visions of going to Grathor and to Shtovokor in life, from here, the monastery of Boreth, people have claimed to have been able to go to Grathor through some entryway in Kristak. Now, others just say, well, it's just allegorical. It's a volcano, and Grathor is like a volcano. So I'm not going to debate that right now. I'm just outlining the story as it's presented. We also establish, though, Kristak still exists to this day. It's a known location on the homeworld. So although we don't know with 100% certainty exactly where the town, the city-state of Sakshub actually was, we know that it must be fairly close to Kristak for, and one would assume one has to cross the Black Hills going to Kristak, so you can kind of draw a line and get a basic idea where Kalis's ancestral home was. That's not important. It's just something I find interesting from a historical standpoint. I'm sure archaeologists are looking into that. So prelude to fight. Now, this is Kalis speaking. "Now, Morath, you can run no more. Your legs are weak, as are your hearts filled with water. All blood is lost. This is the end. Give me the sword, for you know it is mine." He's referring, of course, to his father's sword. And again, this translation, the humans are saying the hearts when they're referring to his eight-chambered heart, but all blood is lost because his heart is filled with water and not blood. He's calling him a coward. He is less than Klingon. He certainly has no right to that sword. He needs to give it over. So 9, the battle. Again, this is a responsorial between the audience, and the lore singer, and it starts with the audience. 12 days, 12 nights. 12 days, 12 nights. 12 days, 12 nights. They fought.
So we can set up a 12th night Klingon holiday.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And normally I would read through this and then we'll go back, but since you caused me to pause here, let's take a look at that. It repeats 12 days and 12 nights three times. Now, this is a little bit beyond my understanding, but I know that there is symbolism in numbers. So the repetition of 12 days and 12 nights three times, and again, as I've said, there is importance in repetition, because not only do you say 12 days and 12 nights in this verse three times, but that is repeated again and again in this canto. So you get it 3, 6, 9, 12, 15, 18 times they repeat this. Now, if there was a symbolism to the number 18, back when this was originally penned down, by tradition, we say that it was 1,500 years ago. I don't know if that's accurate or not, if it was literally written at the time of Caleth's birth, or the time that he lived, or 100 years later, or several generations later. This, I can't say, but tradition says, you know, 1,500 years ago. And unfortunately, the number 18 means nothing more to me than the repetition. And I think that in and of itself is 12 days and 12 nights is significant and important, and it's worth repeating. And I think every school child, every member of the Warriors Academy knows that Kalesh and Morath fought for 12 days and 12 nights. So anyway, let me continue. They fought on and on. The sand beneath their feet turned hard as rock. 12 days, 12 nights. 12 days, 12 nights. 12 days, 12 nights. Their anger so hot it could melt the rock like the mighty Kreshtak. 12 days, 12 nights. 12 days, 12 nights. 12 days, 12 nights. And Morath's strength was gone. The coward threw his sword into the fire streams of Kreshtak. 12 days, 12 nights. 12 days, 12 nights. 12 days, 12 nights. And Kalesh dropped his sword to kill the traitor with bare hands. Morath fell. The end was near. 12 days, 12 nights. 12 days, 12 nights. 12 days, 12 nights. Morath the coward jumped after his sword, dishonored and defeated. 12 days, 12 nights. 12 days, 12 nights. 12 days, 12 nights. And Kalesh was alone, walking along the shore, his fate heavy on his shoulders. Kalesh sits at the shore of the Lake of Fire as an old warrior passes by. Now, I'm going to take a sidestep for a moment here. Of course, this is the story of the battle between Kalesh and Molor, and it's not in the Pachbatk, but tradition states that the loss of his father's sword so grieved Kalesh because it was the only thing he had left of his father. Keep in mind, his father and everything they owned just burned down in the town behind them. The sword was all he had left of his father, and his brother has now thrown it into Kreshtak. So he sits down on the shore and he wept. And tradition says that his tears caused the ocean to overflow its banks. He wept so hard. But that's another story. I'm just, and it may be apocryphal, can't say, but that's a discussion for another time. I want to get through this narrative today if I can. So 10, Kalesh and the warrior. And this is where we came in. This was the canto that you had read. The warrior says, "My Klingon brother, why are you out here when even the Thranks don't grow? Can I help a fellow Klingon in need? May I sit and rest with you?" Kalesh responds, "Dear old friend, I cannot speak of my tragedies. There's nothing left for me." And the warrior said, "If you don't want my help, then let's light a fire and drink. Have some blood wine." Kalesh, "Let us drink then to my father in Grethor and the brother I once had." The warrior, "You are here for great deeds. Your journey will not be forgotten. Restore the honor of your father. to reach the heavens, you must seek underground. I will see you victorious next time. Now, what are we looking at? We are looking at this warrior, this great old warrior, is never named. We have no idea who he is. It doesn't matter, because we know all we need to know of him from the way Kalesh responds to him. He says, "Dear old friend." Now, he doesn't call him by name, so I suspect that when he says, "Dear old friend," he doesn't literally mean somebody that I know that has been my friend. But he is saying, "You stranger that I have met, I respect you as a friend because you have reached out to me." And he has wisdom. So when he says old, it is not derogatory. It is meant with respect. And whenever you see an old warrior in a story like this, you know that they're there to impart some wisdom. And a wise warrior is prepared for that and listens with eagerness, because wisdom begets wisdom, right? And at this moment, Kalesh is feeling a bit lost. He knows he needs to do something, but he's not sure what. He has already promised to restore his father's honor, but he does not know how. And it takes this warrior to kind of see things clearly. I don't need to know your whole story. You're not prepared to share it with me, and that's fine. But you definitely have some struggle, and you've just shared with me that your father is in Grithor. You need to restore his honor. And the way you're going to do that is literally to go into the afterlife. You are going to seek underground, and I will see you victorious next time. Usually when someone goes to Grithor, they do not return. But this warrior claims he will see Kalesh again. And as we know, he will. And that is where I'm going to end at this time, because then we begin the great journey to Grithor and the events that lead to the unification of the Klingon Empire. And that really is most people. What I've just shared today is really just preamble to the war story that we all talk about when we talk about the unification of the empire. But that prologue should not be glossed over. There is a great deal of wisdom there for warriors of all age. It needs to be taught to the youngest, but it needs to be reminded to the oldest.
It's a great deal of character building.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We tend to think of the warrior lessons and the combat skill and the courage and honor and glory that was taught to us by Kalesh. But there were more basic and more simple lessons that he taught us about how to live day to day. We tend to talk about how all Klingons are warriors, whether that's fighting with the weeds to grow strong crops, or teaching the children to be strong warriors, or, you know, fighting the damage incurred on a vessel to restore it to working conditions, whatever the battle is. And you attack it with the conviction that Kalesh demonstrated. Well, unless you look at lessons like this, it's impossible to internalize those lessons in your own life. So, and that's what I do here at the monastery, impart those lessons.
And those of you that are listening to this, if you would like to take these lessons and share them at conventions, there's a couple of ways to do it. You can just talk about the legends of Kalesh as we're talking to you here, or get yourself a copy of the Pakpak and read the lessons in the original Klingon to add flavor to your presentations for the populace.
I also have a YouTube page. Look up Kartan, the Klingon Cleric, on YouTube. And if not this week, then certainly next week, I'm going to be putting up a PowerPoint presentation that I have done at conventions previously that basically give an overview, a very, very brief overview of the history of the Klingon Empire. This that we talked about here today is about a minute and a half of that presentation. We've taken a little bit closer look at it today than I will in that piece. But that'll be up if you want to share that around as well. Give it a like, give it a subscribe, and, you know, hold me to it. I haven't been publishing there very often, but you could spur me on to greater things with some positive feedback over there.
Okay. With that, then, I'd like to thank you, Troy, or Catan, presentation. And for Jajem and myself, I'd like to thank you all for listening, and join us again when we study some more of the wisdom.
Kapah!